Valentine's Day is a fake holiday manufactured to drive consumerism, put pressure on couples, and make single people feel bad. But it is still an opportunity to celebrate love, and that is fine and dandy. I actually had a pretty good Valentine's Day today. I was on TV earlier today, so I'm going to tell y'all about that experience. Had the opportunity to make my second appearance on the world famous Kill Tony podcast. So I'm going to tell you all about that, give you a behind the scenes look. Thank y'all for joining me. We are live right now, so please send your questions, your comments on the live chat. Super chats are absolutely appreciated. They are not required. If you want your question 100% guaranteed answered, send it with a super chat and I will absolutely get to it. Once again, no pressure there. So let's get into it. Okay, so I was on the Love Connection game show on live TV earlier today. That was a pretty cool experience, actually. I really enjoyed it. It was on KINS 5, which is a news station here in San Antonio, Texas, where I live. And I guess for the past few years, they've done this Love Connection game show where they take a bachelor and a bachelorette, and then they have three contestants on each side, and the contestants compete to, get picked by, the bachelor for the ladies and the bachelorette for the guys. So I had to get there at like 8 a.m. this morning, which is super, super early for me to be anywhere. There was the bachelorette and there was me and two other contestants. They asked us some questions. We had to answer the questions. I spent a lot of time talking to the other two contestants that I was up against. They were really cool dudes, Christian and Antonio. We actually had a really fun time just kind of goofing off, talking to each other, but we were definitely competing, trying to win the game show. And I'm going to play some clips from that for y'all, so that you can see how this game show went. The Bachelorette was really, really cool. Absolutely lovely lady. Her name is Carolyn. She had some great questions. I'm going to show y'all my introduction to Carolyn. And then I'm also going to show only one of the questions that Carolyn asked us. You'll have to, go check out Great Day Essay. That's the name of the morning show that we were on, Great Day Essay on KINS 5. And you can go watch the entire show. Or the entire segment from this morning that we did for the Love Connection game show. But the first clip is going to be me introducing myself to Carolyn, the bachelorette, and I'll tell you more about this after I play the clip, because this is kind of funny. Yeah, so here we go.
So nice to meet you. I actually brought you flowers, and they are not from a gas station. I did not buy them from a gas station. I would love to pass these off to you if someone could do that for me.
Okay.
Thank
Somebody's
you.
Unleaded, you Thank know what I'm you.
Okay, so I said specifically that I did not buy those flowers from a gas station, but I absolutely bought those flowers from a gas station. On my way to the news studio this morning, I actually stopped to get Carmex because my lips were super dry. And I didn't want to be on TV with dry, cracked lips. So I stopped by this little gas station to get Carmex, and they had like bouquets of flowers in the gas station. And they were actually for gas station flowers, they weren't that bad. They really weren't. They were in, there were a couple of the bouquets that looked a little bit rough. But they looked nice. And they actually weren't that cheap either. So I picked up one of the bouquets. I thought, it's Valentine's Day. I'm meeting this bachelorette. I should probably get something for her. And so I picked up this bouquet of flowers. The other guys, they didn't bring anything. They didn't bring any flowers. They didn't bring any cards, nothing. So me showing up with those flowers was definitely clutch. And it came in handy later on. Okay, so that was my introduction to Carolyn. Let me play this next clip for you. I'll go ahead and start it again.
What is your go-to karaoke song?
Favorite karaoke song is Higher by Creed.
Wow.
Absolutely love it. And wow. The personal reason behind that is My ex-girlfriend from years and years and years ago used to date Scott Stapp, the lead singer of Creed. And so I just like to honor him anytime I have a chance.
Okay. That's very interesting, but I like it.
So that is 100% a true story, too. Not that Higher is my go-to karaoke song. I can sing Higher, and so it's a great karaoke song for me. Scott Stapp and I have like similar vocal ranges. The personal reason behind why I sing Higher is not because I have such a love and adoration for Scott Stapp. He did actually date my not ex-girlfriend, actually it was my ex-fiance from years and years back. Most of y'all probably know I've never been married. I don't have any kids, but I was engaged at one point, and the lady that I was engaged to, before she dated me, she dated Scott Stapp, the lead singer of Creed. That is absolutely 100% true. It's actually kind of an interesting story, and I thought this would be kind of like a fun way to talk about that because it all just sort of ties back to Valentine's Day. I've talked a little bit about like some of my previous relationships on the podcast before, but I don't think I've ever gone super in depth about my ex-fiance other than, you know, kind of explaining that, you know, she and I both had a pretty serious substance abuse problem when we were together. But we originally met at my apartment complex of all places. It was so strange. Some of my friends were down at the pool one day. She was at the pool as well. And she asked my friends, I guess she'd seen me hanging out with them at the pool before. And she asked them, hey, do y'all know that guy that lives here with the long hair? Because I had really long hair back then, like down to here. I think I've shown pictures of that before. But anyway, they were like, oh yeah, that's our friend Davey. She was like, is he going to be here today? I'd really like to meet him. I showed up to the pool a little bit later. They were all blowing up my phone, just like, dude, you got to get down here. There's a super hot girl that's asking about you and she really wants to meet you. So I show up to the pool later. We ended up going to dinner that night. We went out the next night as well. And from then on, we were pretty much just inseparable. And we were together for, I think, just shy of 4 years, or maybe just over 4 years, actually. This is, once again, this is all back when I was I had a pretty serious substance abuse problem. And so a lot of my memories are kind of hazy when it comes to this stuff. So just bear with me on this. Anyways, so we dated for several years and ultimately I ended up proposing to her. But before I proposed to her, there were some, oh my gosh, we had just such a difficult, I want to say, toxic relationship. Not the entire time we were together, but I had a lot of like issues going on. She had a lot of issues going on, and so we were just toxic for each other. Neither one of us was faithful to the other person at all. The really interesting part that I wanted to kind of get into, because I've told this story on stage before, but I don't think I've ever told it on the podcast before. So before she dated me, like I said, she dated Scott Stapp. While we were together, I think it was like maybe 2 years into the relationship, she and one of her friends went on like this girls trip to Las Vegas. I'm gonna go ahead and take this other video down. There we go. So they went on this girls trip to Las Vegas. It was so strange because while she was in Vegas, I could never like get a hold of her. She just kind of disappeared. I talked to her maybe two or three times while she was in Vegas for 3 or 4 days. And we were, like I said, inseparable. We talked all the time. We would text all the time, call all the time. But while she was in Vegas, she was just kind of, you know, in the wind, basically. While she was there, I saw her like posting on social media, wouldn't return my phone calls or texts, but she would post on social media, which is just so, I mean, that's infuriating if you've ever been through that. I really should have, if I had been in a healthy place, I would have just left her alone, you know, just let her do her thing in Vegas. But I wasn't in a healthy place. And so I was just being completely obsessive about it. Like, oh my God, when is she going to call me? When is she going to text me back? All this stuff. She's posting on social media and still hasn't called me back. What's going on? But she ended up posting this picture on social media, being in a nightclub in Las Vegas with Criss Angel. And for those of you who don't know who Criss Angel is, you've been living under a rock. He's like probably one of the most famous magicians, I would say arguably of all time. It's like David Copperfield, David Blaine, and Criss Angel. Those three guys, I would say, are like, I mean, obviously Houdini, but that was way, way back. So I would say arguably he's one of the most famous magicians of all time. Had his own TV show. But anyway, so she was hanging out in the club with Criss Angel, which I was just like, okay, well, that's interesting. You're hanging out with Criss Angel, but you can't call or text me back. So I was just kind of like losing it, obviously. And then she had called me at one point, or I called her and she finally answered or something along those lines. Once again, a lot of this is really fuzzy for me. But when I talked to her, she was hanging out like at a house party. Like she wasn't at her hotel. She was partying with like a bunch of people and I could hear dudes in the background and all this stuff. I thought that was really strange. And then the next day when I was talking to her, she mentioned that she had been like kind of hanging out with Criss Angel while she was in Vegas. And I just, I mean, I never got like 100% confirmation, but just based on some of the pictures that I saw, some of the text messages that I saw, I can say with like 90%, maybe even 95 to 99% certainty that she definitely cheated on me with Criss Angel while she was in Las Vegas. And the weirdest part was she was there for 3 days, came home, and then literally like a month later went straight back to Vegas. So I think, you know, definitely there was something going on there. And man, that was so damaging for me. And again, not that I was like this perfect boyfriend, because I absolutely was not. But just like knowing that she was out there, you know, hanging out with Criss Angel, you know, doing who knows what with Criss Angel, it just tore me apart. It tore me apart. And I feel like kind of rightfully so. You know, if you've got this hot girlfriend that you're in love with, that you want to get married to and have a family at some point, and now she's hanging out with this celebrity magician. I mean, it's just, oh, it was a punch in the gut. And again, I don't really blame her, because we were both completely toxic for each other, but it was very difficult to deal with. And of course, you know, when you tell your friends about a story like that, here come the jokes, you know, like all the jokes about how, you know, oh, Criss Angel really did make your girlfriend disappear and all this stupid stuff that, you know, obviously I have to laugh at it, but it still hurts a little bit, you know? And here's the other thing, like to me, I never really liked Criss Angel. And I'm not just saying this because, you know, my girlfriend at the time cheated on me with him, but I never really liked Criss Angel because he was always this like weird emo guy doing magic. And for me, emo guys were like for music. Like if you're not playing emo or hardcore music, why are you dressed like an emo guy? And seriously, how many fedoras do you have? Why are you wearing eyeliner to do magic? And all the vests and the flared pants and the affliction gear and the bedazzled everything. I mean, he just annoyed me. He always annoyed me, even before I knew that my girlfriend had cheated on me with him. I just never had a whole lot of respect for Criss Angel. David Blaine, absolutely. Love David Blaine. And I've always said, like, if my girlfriend was going to cheat on me with a magician, I would much rather it be David Blaine. Like, that's one, I feel like that one I could have just been like, you know what? He is pretty cool. I mean, he can do the craziest impossible stuff. But Criss Angel, I was just like, oh man, that sucks. That's a real blow to the ego, you know? So yeah, anyway, she went to Vegas, hung out, and I mean, almost 100% hooked up with Criss Angel while she was there. Came home. It was weird. When she came home, she was in a wheelchair. I almost forgot about that. So I went to pick her up from the airport, and she was in a wheelchair coming out of the airport. And again, she hadn't answered any phone calls. She would only like text me like, hey, here's when I'm going to be in. Can you come and pick me up? Just being very evasive and weird. But yeah, she showed up in a wheelchair. So I picked her up, and when when she like went to get up out of the wheelchair, like she was limping really bad. And I was like, hey, what happened? Are you okay? And she was like, I just need, like, let's just get in the car and I'll tell you on the way home. She gets in the car and she was like, I'm just really, really hungover and I didn't want to walk. I felt like I was going to throw up. And so I got a wheelchair and I just had to pretend like I'd hurt my foot so that they would let me ride around in the wheelchair. I couldn't just tell them I was hungover. Pretty smart. I mean, that's a smart move. Melissa, please don't say that. Please, please, please don't say that. Because that's years later, looking back on it, I'm just like, wow, Chris Angel blew her back all the way out to the point that she literally couldn't walk. You know, like we hear stories about that where, you know, you want to get it so hard that you can't walk the next day. And Chris Angel literally did that to my girlfriend at the time. She said it was from being hungover, but, you know, Melissa Hodgson, you're probably right. And either way, it just hurts my feelings. So after all of that, after that whole debacle, we actually ended up getting engaged. So after my girlfriend cheated on me, I ended up proposing to her. And that was that. That's a whole other situation that happened, because originally, and this is how it all ties back to Valentine's Day, originally I was going to propose on Valentine's Day. That was my original plan. I had rented out like a private room at a restaurant. Like we were going to have this really romantic, intimate dinner, and I was going to propose to her. But the company that she worked at, she always had like really late hours. From what I've been told, there was stuff going on while she was at work as well. That I didn't know about at the time, kind of suspected, but didn't know about. And again, I don't want to paint her as this horrible person, because I was just as bad. All right. I was not faithful. I was, you know, out, what do they call it? Philandering. I don't know, whatever the word is. I was not being a good boy either. So I don't want to make it seem like I was this great boyfriend waiting for her at home and she was off gallivanting around. No, it wasn't like that at all. I was a terrible boyfriend also, but I was going to propose on Valentine's Day. Had the restaurant, you know, all set up. I had talked to, you know, the staff there that I was going to propose and do it in this private room. I just want to make sure it's really special and all this stuff. She actually had to cancel dinner that night because she was going to be stuck at work late. And so that just like ruined the whole proposal. Obviously, I don't want to have to set this all up again. And so I ended up, I think it was like a month after that, I ended up proposing to her just in her living room. I tied the ring around her dog's neck with the ribbon. And you know, she was playing with the dog and found the ring on the ribbon. I was like, what's this? And then I proposed to her that way. So yeah, the Valentine's Day proposal was totally ruined. And once again, found out later through people that she worked with at the time. And then another person that I knew that worked for the company later, apparently she had like a pretty wild reputation at this company. I'm not going to say the name of the company. I'm not even going to say the name of my ex, but she had a pretty wild reputation at this company, essentially granting favors to clients to get business. And this is in the construction industry. And so there was one story that a friend of mine told me where she was caught in like the construction manager's trailer that's on site. So usually if you're like a foreman or a project manager, you have a trailer that essentially functions as your mobile office when you're working on a big project, right? And so she got caught in the trailer, you know, I was going to say with her pants down, but it was actually, I think, his pants that were down. So either way, she got caught, right? Even some family members that worked in the construction industry had heard about her and just never told me. They didn't want to tell me. You know, I found out after the fact. They were like, yeah, she wasn't cool. She was doing some pretty sketchy stuff that you didn't know about. And I asked, I was like, why didn't you tell me? And they were like, how do you tell a family member that their girlfriend is cheating on them while she's at work? Like, that's a really difficult conversation to have. And we just figured that you would find out, which, you know, I did later on. The good news here is, so again, going back to the proposal, the Valentine's proposal didn't work out. Proposed in her living room. Ultimately, we were supposed to get married. Again, I don't remember the date that the wedding was supposed to happen. It's all just, you know, kind of fuzzy memories from back then. But anyways, we'd sent out invitations. We wanted to have a really small wedding, but it was going to be a pretty big wedding. We'd rented out the venue. We'd picked out cakes. She'd picked out a dress. We had the caterers reserved. I mean, everything was happening. And then we'd even started getting presents, like from people that were going to attend the wedding. Yeah, we started getting presents, so basically 30 days before the wedding was supposed to happen, I canceled it. I told her that I couldn't do it. I was worried that it wasn't going to work out anyway, and I didn't want to get married and, you know, go through all that only to get divorced in a matter of months, because we'd broken up and gotten back together several different times at this point. So yeah, it was like a whole mess, obviously. Because when you cancel a wedding 30 days before it's supposed to happen, you don't really have time. I mean, you can notify everyone. You can try to notify everyone. And we did try to let everybody know, like, hey, the wedding's not happening anymore. But people still showed up to the venue that we had reserved the day that the wedding was supposed to happen. We got the presents, didn't return them, which I still feel kind of bad about. But I'm pretty sure everyone on my side of the family knew that the wedding was canceled. I think it was her side that wasn't informed. And so all the presents came from her side of the family. So I don't think it affected my side at all. But yeah, it was a mess. And I mean, obviously, you know, she was really upset. Her parents were furious. Her friend, it was so weird. So she and her friends had like this like bachelorette party before the wedding was supposed to happen, like several weeks before the wedding was supposed to happen. And it was a really weird experience. They stayed in San Antonio and then went to Austin. So her friends flew in from out of town to San Antonio, and then they took a girls trip to Austin. And it was really, really strange, because, you know, they were staying at the house that my ex and I had together. And one of her friends, I never understood why this happened, but she had like this conversation with me at one point. Like, I remember it vividly. It was out on our back patio. We had a giant yard and this big wooden deck. And we were standing on this wooden deck, and her friend who was going to be her maid of honor was talking to me, and she started crying, telling me how, you know, how much she appreciated me and how well I treated my ex, and basically told me, please, like, don't mess this up. Please marry her. Please don't back out, essentially, which was really, really strange to me. Obviously, if two people are in a healthy relationship, their friends aren't going to be thinking like, oh, this, they're not going to be thinking from the get-go, like, this isn't going to work. You know, so at the time it was very, very strange. But then, you know, a few weeks later when I had to call off the wedding because things were just so bad at that point, it kind of all made sense. You know, Nuria, the seed was planted at that point. No, I just thought it was weird. Honestly, at the time, I just thought it was really strange. But yeah, a couple weeks later when I actually did call off the wedding, and I called off the wedding because the substance abuse had just gotten so bad. And it was, I mean, it was bad for both of us. Don't get me wrong. Like, we were, you know, both having pretty serious issues. But the substance abuse was awful. The fighting was awful. And it just, I knew what had to be done. I was very resistant to it. My parents had actually begged me not to go through with the wedding, but you know, I, at this point, still had kind of a strained relationship with my parents. Not bad at all, but I wasn't sober at this point. And so, you know, I hadn't really dealt with some of the mental health issues that I needed to address from, you know, growing up in a cult and the trauma with that. I was still actively using and drinking. And so I was just in a bad place, and I didn't want to hear it from my parents. But one of my really good friends, who I have always respected his opinion and always looked up to him, and he sat me down and told me, "Hey, look, man, this is obviously your decision. But I just want you to know," because I told him about a lot of the fights that me and my ex were having. I mean, we were just having so many different fights. And he sat me down and was like, "Look, man, you do what you want, but I will tell you, the problems that you're having now, before you're married, they don't get better after you're married. They only get worse." And for some reason, that really struck a chord with me. I think it's because, like, when I proposed, I was doing that because we were having so many issues. And I was like, well, if I propose and now we're engaged, like, some of these issues we'll be able to resolve. We won't be having all these problems anymore. And that was like part of the mentality. Obviously, I loved her and I wanted to marry her, but also we were, you know, having issues. And I thought this might help with some of the issues that we're having, and it didn't. Things got worse. And so when he said it's going to get even worse after you get married, I was like, whoa, I don't know how much worse it could really get. To me, it's the same for a lot of couples. You know, they're in a toxic relationship and they think, oh, well, if we get married, it'll be good. Or worse yet, hey, if we have kids, that'll fix things. It doesn't, you know, and I've seen that happen time and time again. And so I'm so glad that he said that to me, because I think I probably would have gone through with the wedding if he hadn't brought up that specific piece of advice. When you get married, the fights that you have, the issues that you have, the problems that you have, they don't get better, they get worse. And so, like I said, that just resonated with me. And I called off the wedding like a couple days after he and I had that conversation. And so, yeah, it was like this whole thing. It was awful. It was, I recognize like my part of that, like that is messed up. Like, you know, I should have called it off way earlier. I shouldn't have proposed in the first place. You know, we weren't in a good spot. The relationship was not healthy. I should not have proposed in the first place, but I did. Calling off a wedding 30 days before it's supposed to happen is messed up. Like it really is. But it's not as messed up as if I had just bailed out, gotten cold feet the day of the wedding, or gotten married knowing that's not what I wanted to do, and then, you know, just getting divorced a couple months later. So I feel like while it was a bad situation, and I definitely made mistakes along the way, I am glad that I didn't, you know, get cold feet the day of the wedding, or worse yet, go through with it knowing that this is not the right, I shouldn't be doing this. I am glad that I kind of like followed my heart in that aspect, as messed up as my heart was at the time, because of all the substance abuse. But yeah, anyway, that, you know, ever since that relationship, you know, I've been in some very healthy relationships since then. I've been in some very toxic relationships since then. I know that I do better now with relationships than I did when I was still, you know, actively using and struggling with addiction. I definitely know how to tap into my own feelings. I know how to be more genuine. I know how to communicate better, you know, all that fun stuff. Some of that stuff has probably come with age as well, but I think most of it has come from, like, you know, really taking my own mental health seriously. But, you know, after that experience of getting engaged and it not working out, I think it has like created like a little bit of a complex in me where I'm always just a little bit nervous about going from like serious boyfriend and girlfriend to the marriage talks. Like the marriage talks, I don't think I have a fear of commitment necessarily. I don't think I'm gun shy when it comes to marriage. I think it just, I have some holdover trauma from that relationship and how that turned out. And I think it definitely has impacted, some of my relationships since then. I don't know. That was a tough thing to go through. And, you know, the interesting part about all of this is we stayed together after we called off the wedding. I specifically told her, I was like, I don't want to break up with you. I still want to marry you. I still want to have a life with you. I just don't want to go through with the wedding right now because I mean, all of this feels so toxic right now. So we were supposed to stay together. We took a little bit of a break after I called off the wedding. She went and, you know, lived with her family for a little bit. Came back, you know, she did come home, after like, I think it was a couple weeks, came back cause we lived together at the time. But it was just, it wasn't that long after, she ended up having to go to a treatment facility, which I mean, that was a nightmare too. She ended up having to go to a treatment facility. She got kicked out of the treatment facility, because of, paraphernalia that she brought in with her, and then shared with other patients at the treatment facility. So she got kicked out for that. I went to go and find her. I'm pretty sure I've told this part of the story before. I went to go and find her because I couldn't get a hold of her. The treatment facility basically called me and said, hey, we had to discharge your girlfriend because of a situation that happened here. I went to go find her. I mean, it was an absolute miracle that I found her. I still don't know how I found her ultimately. But anyways, we had a conversation after I found her on the side of the road. We talked and she basically told me, hey, you've got to let me go. I don't want to be with you and you have to let me go. And that was essentially our breakup. That was the breakup conversation. We did talk again afterwards, but things weren't ever the same. She did end up going to another treatment facility. She got sober for, you know, a brief period of time. So what actually ended up happening after we had the conversation where she said, you have to let me go. I don't want to be with you. I need to take care of myself right now. A couple weeks later, she ended up dating another guy that was part of the, I'll call it recovery community, where she ended up finally, you know, going to rehab, ended up dating this guy, like literally 2 weeks after she and I had broken up. And so that was like really, really difficult for me to handle as well. But I mean, that was her decision. And, you know, I don't see how it could have worked out after everything that happened and after, you know, canceling the wedding, after the rehab stuff, after, you know, all the cheating, after just all the toxicity. I really don't think we could have fixed it. And so it was honestly probably better for her to start dating another guy so that I could kind of move on with my life too and not still be so wrapped up with her. But all of that was, you know, the situation with her getting kicked out of a treatment facility and breaking up with me and then, you know, ending up with this other dude, that was, all of that was like kind of the catalyst that got me sober. So as painful and as difficult as it was, it actually did work out, which is kind of cool. This is kind of morbid, but the guy that she, you know, dated after me that she met while she was in a treatment facility. That guy ended up passing away a couple years later from an overdose, which was, I mean, just super sad. I mean, he and I had several mutual friends in the sober community, I'll call it. And so it was a really tough deal. I didn't know him personally. I felt sad that, you know, someone lost their life to the disease of addiction, but obviously didn't tear me up a whole lot. But anyways, he ended up passing away. I know it was really, really hard on her. And, I haven't talked to her in years. No idea what she's up to. As far as I know, she probably still struggles with her addiction issues. I wouldn't be surprised at all, just because, you know, if you don't get the help that you need, or let me rephrase that. If you don't accept the help that you need, I don't think you can ever get well. It takes getting sober for me. It wasn't that overly hard once I was truly ready. I tried to get sober multiple times before I was really ready, and it was always impossible. But once I was truly ready and ready to, you know, essentially give up everything that I had tried before, all my preconceived notions, you know, finally realized that I couldn't control this, that it was going to ultimately kill me if I let it. Once I finally gave up and gave in, it was really easy to get sober. For me, it was. It was difficult to stay sober at times. There's help out there for people who struggle with sobriety, struggle with addiction, whatever you want to call it. There's so much help out there that's available, and there's options that work. And it definitely worked for me. And I know for a fact, if it can work for me, it can work for anyone. And I know that because it worked for me, I know it could work for my ex. I don't think she really wants it. I don't think she does. I think she would prefer just to stay in her addiction, because it is comfortable. Like it becomes habit. It becomes a safety blanket for you. And it's very hard to give up. Like Nuria said, it's the same as any other, you know, addictive thing, like cigarettes, sugar, eating. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you can get addicted to, and you can really only get over it once you want to, once you're ready to, and you want to. I had to hit that crazy rock bottom with the canceling the wedding, having to go and find my girlfriend on the streets after she got kicked out of rehab, and you know, everything that came after that. So I mean, I had to hit a pretty intense rock bottom, not as intense as other people's. I mean, there's buddies I have that had to go all the way homeless before they were finally ready to get sober. Fortunately, I didn't have to do that. But some people do, and that's just how it is. But yeah, once again, as difficult as traumatizing as that whole experience was with my ex, and you know, having to call off a wedding and rehab, and as difficult as all of that was, I mean, it really was what I needed to finally realize, like, hey, I can't keep living like this anymore. I gotta make changes here. It all worked out, you know. So that's kind of like my little Valentine's Day story that I wanted to share with y'all. But I also wanted to tell y'all about the recent appearance that I made on the Kill Tony podcast, which was so incredibly cool. I've talked about this before. So this podcast is probably one of the most popular podcasts, I would say, in the world right now. I mean, obviously Joe Rogan's podcast is super popular. There's a few others that are, I feel like it's a lot of true crime podcasts are really, really popular. But the Kill Tony podcast, I mean, this thing, they just sold out two shows at Madison Square Gardens to attend a live, like a live episode of the podcast. All the podcasts are filmed live in front of an audience. And basically the setup here is that there's Tony Hinchcliffe and Brian Redban, and they're the guys that started the podcast. And there's a panel of comedian judges. They're not really judges. They're just there to hang out and comment and talk and crack jokes, really. So there's this panel of comedians and Tony Hinchcliffe and Brian Redban, and they perform this podcast in front of a live audience. And the idea is that they have open mic comedians and some people who have never done comedy before and other people who have been doing comedy for years. They get a chance to go on stage and tell jokes for 60 seconds. And then at the end of their 60 seconds, Tony and the comedian panel, they essentially critique the 60 seconds of stand-up and then do an interview with the comedians. It's incredibly entertaining, so much fun to watch. They have regular performers. Hans Kim is one. David Lucas used to be a regular performer. Now Cam Patterson. So David Lucas retired from the podcast. Now Cam Patterson took his place as a regular. And then the great William Montgomery is also a regular on this podcast. They have recurring guests as well. I mean, they've had everyone on this podcast. They've had Joe Rogan as part of the comedian panel, Tom Segura, Theo Vaughn, Bobby Lee, Post Malone was on one, Bert Kreischer, Whitney. I mean, they've had pretty much any big name comedian that you've ever heard of has been on this podcast as part of the comedian panel judging the 60-second stand-up, right? So it's really fun. It's very popular. I was on the podcast about 7 months ago for the first time. It was Tony Hinchcliffe, Brian Redband, and then Pauly Shore and Eric Griffin were the two guest comedians. And I got up there. I did my 60 seconds to stand up. They thought I did a good job with the jokes. They started doing the interview process. And at one point I was talking about how I had been stabbed by an ex-girlfriend, which I've talked about on this podcast before. And Pauly Shore just did not believe me at all and actually wanted to like see the scar. And this happened, I mean, this happened like 15 years ago. And so if you can still see the scar at all, it's like a hairline. Like it's gone pretty much. And I tattooed over it. So he couldn't find the scar. And so, you know, he called me a liar and all this stuff, which was super, super funny because I'd actually opened up, I'd hung out with and opened up at a show for Pauly Shore before this. So, you know, it was fun. It was for the bit. It was very entertaining, all that fun stuff. So that was about 7 months ago. And then a few weeks ago, I got the chance to go and do a second appearance on the podcast, which was just really cool. And it all happens at Joe Rogan's club in Austin, Texas, the Comedy Mothership, which is probably like the biggest thing in comedy that's happening right now. Right. So that was also a really cool experience, just getting to be in the Comedy Mothership again. So at any rate, this time the guests were Harland Williams. I don't know how many of y'all know who Harland Williams is, and Yiannis Pappas. So Harland Williams is a comedian actor. One of my favorite movies growing up was Dumb and Dumber. I mean, that movie, I don't even know how many times I've watched it. It's that one and Ace Ventura. I was a huge Jim Carrey fan, and his movies were some of the first I was not allowed to watch. I wasn't allowed to watch them, but when I would stay with my grandparents, they had them on VHS. And so those were some of like the first real movies that I was ever able to watch. And Harland Williams is actually in Dumb and Dumber. If you remember the scene where Jim Carrey's character is peeing into a beer bottle because they can't pull over. And then they get pulled over by a motorcycle cop and he takes a sip of what he thinks is beer, but it's actually pee. The motorcycle cop is Harland Williams. And I mean, his character absolutely stole that scene. It was so funny. And so I've always been a huge fan, huge admirer of Harlan Williams. And so to get to perform in front of him was just, I mean, absolutely incredible. But the cooler part was that I had, I mean, probably, I don't ever remember getting this type of audience feedback on a joke that I've done. I mean, I've had, you know, I've had massive applause breaks. I performed in front of a crowd of 500 people all going crazy for my jokes. But this particular set that I did, and again, it's only 60 seconds, but this particular set that I did, just, I mean, it shocked me. And you can see, I'll play the clip for you, and you can see like kind of the shock on my face, like how loud the audience is responding to the joke. And I'm only going to show you all a couple of clips from it. And then if you want to watch the whole thing, you can see it here on YouTube. Just go search, you know, Kill Tony Podcast and the episode with Harlan Williams and Giannis Pappas. Giannis Pappas, he was the other guest that I mentioned. I mean, he's just an incredible comedian. I've always been a huge fan of his. And so getting to perform in front of both of those guys was just so cool. Like, I was definitely starstruck. I mean, if you watch the episode, you can tell I was very much starstruck. But let me go ahead and play a clip of my 60-second set on this last episode of Kill Tony. So here's a clip from
that. If God didn't want me to have sex with Down syndrome people, hang on, whoa. If God didn't want me to have sex with Down syndrome people, why did he make all their asses so fat? Like all of them, they're all caked up in dump trucks on what? All of them. And I'm not supposed to hit that. What I'm trying to say is I miss my ex.
Yeah. So, I mean, just getting crazy audience feedback for that bit. I probably should have warned y'all initially. It's definitely an offensive joke. And that's part of like kind of this whole podcast is very much based on, you know, the classic dick and fart jokes, right? And so doing a joke in 60 seconds, you know, what works really well is doing like really dirty jokes or really offensive jokes, really edgy jokes, if you want to call it that. So yeah, that's one of my more extremely offensive jokes. But it is just a joke. You know, it's been interesting. I posted this clip on my social media and it has over 500,000 views on social media now. And I actually expected to get a lot more negative feedback, but I didn't. So I feel like that was kind of surprising for me. I definitely got some negative feedback, but not nearly as much as I thought I was going to get because of the subject matter of the joke. You know, but I think that also kind of shows that the tide is kind of shifting and people are kind of understanding more that these are just jokes. It's not serious. It's not meant to be offensive. I think there's definitely comedians out there. I've talked about this before, the whole thing with Matt Rife, right? Matt Rife didn't mean to create any offense when he told those jokes about abuse. It was meant to be funny. It wasn't meant to hurt anyone's feelings. There are definitely comedians out there, though, who intentionally try to hurt feelings. But I don't consider those true comedians. I just consider those mean people that happen to have a microphone, right? A true comedian telling jokes, the goal is not to hurt anyone's feelings. It's just to make you laugh. And so I think people are starting to understand that a little bit more, which is why maybe I didn't get quite as much negative feedback as I expected to get. There were definitely some comments that said, this is horrible. It's never funny to say that, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, I think I probably only saw, like, for a video that had as many like views and comments as it did, I mean, it was, the negative comments were very, very limited. Like, a surprisingly limited number of negative comments. I got more hate mail over, you know, doing a video about Gen Z slang than I did you know, with this particular joke, which completely shocked me, but cool. I mean, maybe people are finally starting to make the connection between stand-up comedy and not getting offended. I don't know. But I was just happy that it was well-received. I was really happy in the moment performing at the Comedy Mothership in front of this gigantic crowd and getting the kind of, you know, audience response that I did. I mean, that was just the coolest feeling. And you know, the panel was really cool too. One thing that a few folks mentioned, I can't really zoom this in, but if you look at Harlan Williams' face in the clip here, so Giannis Pappas is smiling, Tony Hinchcliffe, he's grinning ear to ear, and Harlan Williams is just looking at me in horror. Like, he's insanely offended and shocked by this joke, but that's what he was doing for everyone's sets. So there were probably about 15 different comics that went up and performed their 60-second stand-up. And for every single comic, he was doing this like fake shocked look. And he would look at the crowd just like, I can't believe that he's saying this or she's saying this. And he would be shaking his head. But he was joking the entire time. He was like kind of playing a character. He was just absolutely amazing. And I would really encourage y'all to go and watch this episode just to see Harlan Williams, because he is absolutely hilarious. I also wanted to play a little bit of, so after I did my set, after I did my 60 seconds of stand-up, Tony Hinchcliffe always starts the interview. And usually he makes a comment about your jokes, maybe a comment about your looks, and then starts asking questions. So after I finished my set, this was Tony Hinchcliffe's reaction.
Amazing. This is unbelievably well performed, well written, well executed performance. It's so cool to see that Chris D'Elia has reinvented himself. Unbelievable.
17's legal in Texas,
Tony. Wow.
Yeah, so I mean, that was obviously very cool to get that, you know, positive feedback from Tony Hinchcliffe, because I mean, he does this podcast every single week, so he sees thousands of comedians trying this 60 seconds of stand-up, and so for him to give kudos like that was really, really cool. But then for him to say that I look like Chris D'Elia, I mean, if you've ever seen my live streams on other social media platforms, there's two comparisons. Actually, there's three comparisons I always get. It's always Chris D'Elia, Sebastian Stan, the Winter Soldier, and Shooter McGavin. Those three are the most common like celebrity doppelganger comments that I get. And so he jumped right in with the Chris D'Elia thing. It caught me off guard a little bit, but I was able to recover with the, hey, 17's legal in Texas, Tony, because we all know that, you know, Chris D'Elia had some issues a few years back. But all in all, like, Tony was really, really cool. You know, just praising the performance. I appreciated it so much. And what was really awesome is that after the show, I actually got invited to hang out with the staff and the crew in the private bar at the Comedy Mothership. It's called Mitzi's Bar. So after big shows, after the podcast, performers will hang out in Mitzi's Bar. They'll hang out there all night. It's crazy. Like, and they just all party and drink and go crazy. It's super fun. It's really, really cool. But I got invited to hang out with everyone, which apparently doesn't happen. Like, that never, ever happens. I was talking to one of my friends and she said, I've never heard of, you know, one of the comedians, like one of the bucket pull comedians, because they pull all the names out of a bucket to determine who gets to do 60 seconds. She'd never heard of one of the bucket pulls being invited to hang out at Mitzi's after the show. So apparently that was like a really, really big deal. If it does happen, it doesn't happen that often. So I got to go and I hung out with Tony Hinchcliffe, Brian Redman, of course, Giannis Pappas was there. Harlan Williams was hanging out, got to talk to him for a little bit. Pauly Shore was there. Pauly Shore just so happened to be there. Got to talk to him for a little bit and catch up and, you know, tell him that I really didn't appreciate him calling me a liar the first time I was on the Kill Tony podcast. So we had a laugh about that. The coolest part of hanging out at Mitzi's was the incredible, legendary Ron White was there. One of my absolute heroes in stand-up comedy. And he was hanging out at Mitzi's after the show. So I got to go introduce myself to him. You know, told him, you know, I've been a fan for years. You're an absolute legend. It's incredible to meet you. And he told me that I had a great set on Kill Tony, which, I mean, I didn't even know what to say. I was like, I was definitely starstruck. I never, ever get starstruck, but Ron White did it for me. I didn't even know what to say when he told me I had a great set. I was just like, oh my God, thank you. Thank you so much. This means more to me than you'll ever know. Being told I had a great set by Ron White was like the biggest compliment I think I will ever get. I don't think anyone can top that. The other cool thing that I found out after the fact was that apparently Joe Rogan was watching my set. Like, he had snuck into, so the Comedy Mothership in the big room, there's two rooms in the Comedy Mothership. There's the room called the Little Boy, and then there's the room called the Fat Man. Those are obviously references to the A-bombs, right? That got dropped on Japan. Anyways, so yeah, Little Boy and Fat Man are the two rooms. Little Boy is the smaller room. The Fat Man is the big room. And the Fat Man has two levels, right? So there's the floor seats, and then there's a section in the, like in the a balcony area, kind of almost like a mezzanine type situation. And you can't buy tickets for up there. You have to be invited to sit up there. And so a lot of celebrities, you know, important people will sit up in the balcony to watch the shows. And apparently that night, Joe Rogan was up there watching my performance. And someone, a buddy of mine, a guy that I know, was up there with him and actually messaged me afterwards and was like, hey, dude, Joe Rogan watched your set and was laughing, seemed to be really enjoying it. So that's pretty cool. So that was huge for me too. I actually posted a picture on my social media that my buddy took from the balcony, and there's like a head. So you can see me. It's like a faraway shot. So you can see me and, you know, Giannis Papas, Harlan Williams, Tony Hinchcliffe, Brian Redband, and then me over here on the side. But then kind of like almost silhouetted, there's this head. And he sent me the picture and he was like, hey, that's Joe Rogan's head, by the way. He's watching your set. So that was just really, really cool. I mean, the whole experience was just amazing. Had a blast. The first time doing the show, I mean, was absolutely cool. I had a great set, had a fun time. But this second time, I mean, honestly, it kind of makes me nervous to go back for a third time because I don't know if I can top that. I mean, I know I can top that, but like, it's just intimidating having a set that good. Like, how are you ever going to, how is lightning going to strike twice in that type of scenario? You know? So, I mean, I know I will do it again. But I've been thinking about that. Like, how do I top the last performance? Like, how do I make it even bigger and better? So yeah, pretty cool stuff. There's just been so much cool stuff happening lately, y'all. There's a couple other things that I can't talk about yet that I'm working on currently. One of the things I can tell you about is that I'm going to be doing a run of shows here in Texas with the incredibly funny Nick Coletti. If you don't know who Nick Coletti is, first of all, shame on you, but he is the Saw dude. Remember that from back on Vine? Saw dude. The What the Fuck Is Up, Kyle guy. If you haven't seen that clip, I don't know anyone that's never seen that clip because it's just that incredibly popular. So I'll be doing several shows with Nick Coletti here in Texas. We're going to be performing tomorrow night, as a matter of fact, in Austin, Texas at Cap City Comedy. And then week after next, we'll be here in San Antonio at the Laugh Out Loud Comedy Club. And then we'll be going to Houston, to the Houston Improv. And then we'll be in Dallas at the Addison Improv. So that's going to be so much fun. I've done shows with Nick before. He's just the coolest, sweetest guy. So really looking forward to doing stand up with him again. I'm going to go ahead and see if we got any questions. Let's see. Oh, here we go. Did I ever get in touch with Holly's kids? So I actually made the decision not to reach out to her kids. I really didn't want to violate any privacy there, just because I wouldn't want anyone reaching. If I had kids, I wouldn't want people reaching out to them. I wouldn't want someone reaching out to my parents. And so I just decided not to do that. But if you didn't see the live episode that we did with Lindsay Williams and Chad Harris, Holly's nephew reached out to me, and we had him on that live stream to confirm that Holly was definitely not ever in the cult, and is not like a fundamentalist Christian. She's actually Mormon. So he confirmed a lot of stuff for us. So yeah, I decided not to reach out. I didn't want to, I didn't want to violate any privacy there. Do I ever do improv? Question from Swedeproof. No, I've never done like group improv or anything like that. That's not really, I mean, I do crowd work and that sort of thing. I definitely do like comedy sketches that we'll film and put on social media, but I've never done like traditional improv. I respect it so much that their process is completely different from stand-up comedy. They're like the Groundlings, I think, is probably like the most famous improv group. It's kind of like a farm team for SNL. A lot of SNL people have come from the Groundlings, but I never really had any interest in doing improv. I'll probably try it at some point just to give it a shot. I know they have an improv group here in San Antonio. They used to perform in this really cool old theater that I went to way back. Haven't been since, but yeah, you're right. I should probably try that at some point. There's just been so much cool stuff happening, y'all. And obviously, I cannot tell y'all how much I appreciate your support week in, week out, doing the live streams, doing the recorded episodes. I mean, it's just, I don't think I can ever adequately express my gratitude for all the love and support from y'all here on YouTube, from the folks on my other social media accounts. I mean, this is the whole reason I do it. Because it brings me so much joy to know that other people are laughing along, and having a good time, enjoying the content, enjoying the jokes. So yeah, it's really, really cool. Nuria, yes, I am still doing, a Friday show. So we started doing a secret show at a new comedy club in downtown San Antonio. If you want more information, hit me up on social media, but every single Friday we do a show at the Station Comedy Club. You can follow them on social media. The website is stationcomedy.com, but we do a secret show every Friday at 11 PM. It's a secret lineup. We usually have some really cool surprise guests that drop in, and it's a free show. It's a free show that we do every week at 11 p.m. We're also going to be doing some really cool headliner shows coming up with some really big name comedians that I'm really excited about. Craig Conant is one of the first guys that's going to be doing a show, and that's going to be on April 13th. But he has two shows scheduled right now, and one of them is all the way sold out. The other one is close to selling out. So if you want to come see Craig Conant, make sure you get tickets to that. The first showcase that we're doing at this new club, I'm actually doing it with, some of y'all might know this guy, Justin Governall. He's been a buddy of mine for a long time. He was on Naked and Afraid, two different episodes of Naked and Afraid on the Discovery Channel. Super, super cool dude. Former Marine sniper, just a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. Really, really cool guy. And so we are doing a showcase called Half Naked and Mostly Afraid. And that is going to be on March 9th. And that'll be at this new club in San Antonio called The Station. Once again, you can look up shows, get tickets at stationcomedy.com. Please like, comment, and subscribe, y'all, here on YouTube. I appreciate you so much. Like I said, all the engagement helps more than you know. Obviously, follow me on social media at Davey Jacks, and we will see you next Wednesday. I love y'all so much. Thank you. Bye.